You may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Joseph A. Sanzone, and I'm here with Joseph R. Sanzone, my son, who's here for the first time before the court, and he assisted me with this case throughout. It's an interesting case, and our two points in this case are the declaratory judgment relief is not appropriate because there is an adequate remedy in law, and there are other ways to proceed in this matter. And secondly, and most importantly, I think, in this case, we say that you cannot grant an estate and land through the use of a declaratory judgment, that it's not an appropriate way to substitute for the grant of an estate and land.
Isn't that mixing two different concepts? I mean, whether or not there's a remedial right to an injunction in this case or an order to record the document in the land records, I mean, that's always governed by substantive law. It's not governed by the deck action statute. That's just a procedural device. So putting aside deck action, breach of contract action, whatever, if this was not a property interest being conveyed, it was just simply a license for life to use, did the trial judge make any mistake otherwise?
Justice Kelsey, I think you and I have dealt with notice before in the recording of matters, and I do think that in this case he did make a mistake because he granted in his order, if you look at the relief that was sought and the relief that was granted, in his order he attempted to expand what was in the original writing and said that the plaintiffs are entitled to reasonable exclusive use and occupancy of the addition, including a non-exclusive right of ingress and egress across the driveway leading from 2169 Clark's Road.
I thought what you were going to say is the court granted an injunction, which would not be appropriate for a breach of contract, would be appropriate for protecting land interest, and the court took the document, the contractual document, and recorded it in the deed book, which you would not do for a simple license. You would only do for a life estate in property law.
Well, Your Honor, that's my point, that I think he's trying to convert it into a life estate. That's the only way that you would record it. And if it were a life estate, it could be recorded. But I don't know of any non-exclusive possessory life estates. In this particular case, my client continues to be the owner of the property. He continues, according to the writing, to have the right to sell the property at his discretion without any limitation. He can sell it. And there appears to be what...
Which, as a matter of law, you could not do if there were a life estate. You couldn't extinguish the life estate in tenure under common law by deeding it away.
Yes, Your Honor. And that, again, is referenced in the court's ruling by its restatement of the terms of the right, which gets us back to our original point, which is that they always had an adequate remedy at law. And all of their complaints have accrued and matured. I've had a problem reading both of these briefs together because we have such a great distinction, such a great disagreement on the facts of the case and of the law that applies. And if you look back, I believe that the plaintiff attempted to put all of their complaints about what my client had done, starting on page 28 through page 36 of the appendix. And if I could summarize those just by saying that they complained that my client had put property on the back porch. That's accrued, it's matured, it's something that could be litigated in a breach of contract action under the writing. They said that my client had blocked the breezeway, that my client had limited the plaintiff's access to the utility closet. My client had installed a metal gate on the breezeway, but they both put it there together. My client had prevented the security system from being installed. Someone had put a nail in the deadbolt, not necessarily my client, there's no evidence of that. That my client plugged extension cords into the electrical outlets. That that my client had run the brother off, removed furniture, had their stuff on the porch, and had cars in the yard. All of those who recruited and matured and were properly subject of a contract action.
But let me ask, but they didn't ask for a remedy for any of those things. What they asked for was like, look, all this stuff has happened. Judge, tell us, can he do that or can he? Can he nail doors shut? Can he tell my friends not to come to the house? You let us know. What are our rights regarding this piece of property? So I guess to me it almost seems like you're mixing apples and oranges. Well, they use those as examples, but I didn't see that they asked for any relief for those things.
I don't think that they did. And one of the problems with proceeding this way is that you can proceed in the declaratory judgment action without proving a breach. And what they want to do is they want the court to come
in. That's part of the rub here. The deck action statute is just a procedural device, but substantive law fills it. Yeah. There's no substantive law of contracts unique to deck actions or tort actions or anything. It's just a procedural device.
Yes.
It allows you to come in a step earlier than ripeness.
That's true.
Okay.
And so going back to my argument about each one of these things, they've accrued and matured. And it's not like the cases where they are asking you to determine what's happened with future conduct. And their main argument that they advance in this case is that my client has somehow attempted to eject them, attempted to remove them from the property, and there's no evidence at all in this case that that happened. In fact, the evidence is my client had a long-standing relationship with his mother, had bailed her out over and over and over again, and that despite the fact that the Beamans had stolen property and had been convicted, Mr. Beaman had been convicted of petty larceny for stealing a camera on the property after all this happened.
Mr. Sanzone, if I may interrupt again, but you realize if you win on the merits, in other words, if the trial court erred in issuing an injunction on essentially a breach of contract issue, trial court erred by recording a mere license as if it were a life estate. Let's suppose for the sake of argument you win those points. The fact that it didn't plead damages means that res judicata is going to shut them down, so if there's a later breach of contract action on the license for money damages, what that means is all these truly accrued aspects of the claim are gone for res judicata purposes.
Well, I think so.
Well, then I would expect that being the possible advantage you have, you would not want this to be dismissed without prejudice on the deck action point.
Well, we've already been to court on these, and you have a case pending before you on the second portion of this case. And what they've been able to do is they've converted the writing and the right to go forward as a breach of contract on the writing to now a right to go forward with respect to the order. Now they say that when we do something, it's not that we violated the writing and breached the writing. Now we violated the court order. We think it's inappropriate for the court to codify the writing and to establish it as a contract in a court order, because we say that's no more than an advisory opinion. Back again to the issue, we've never attempted to take them off the property. They're there today. They were there throughout this, and there's no evidence of that having taken place. And with that, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
All right.
May it please the court, my name is Chad Mooney and I represent the appellees, Mr. and Mrs. Beaman, in this matter. We believe that the trial court's decision should be affirmed for three reasons. Number one, that the trial court properly heard the declaratory judgment action because an action at law had not matured, accrued, nor would it even redress some of the harm caused by advances. And number two, that the contract did convey a life estate because the contract clearly stated that they were to live in the house until they
died. Contract also stated the owner could sell the property at will and extinguish whatever claim there was to a lifetime contractual tenure there. That would not be possible if it were a true property interest in a life estate. Why isn't that a game over proposition?
Well, it's a little bit of an unusual circumstance, and I think that's what brought us here in the first place, is that the Vances own the entire property.
Right, but can a life estate, a property interest life estate, can it be extinguished by the owner, not the owner of the life estate, the owner of the remainder interest, simply by selling it? And that's the whole point of making something a life estate and recording the deed book, is because it can't be extinguished by the remainder interest, the ultimate owner.
Well, whether it's called a life estate or whatever you want to call it, whatever estate and land, or if it's even a license, the purpose and the reason that we're here is the Beamans want to live in that house for the remainder of their lives and record it. Put the rest of the world on
notice. The problem is, whether it's a life estate in property law or a mere license to use property is a gigantic distinction. You don't get injunctions for breach of contract. You get injunctions for property interest cases. You get specific performance in the narrowest of contexts. Probably inappropriate here. So the whole injunctive remedy falls apart immediately if you go from a property interest case to a mere license to use.
Well, we don't think a license applies in this particular instance because there wasn't any reservation of revocability, even though there was a condition subsequent that would possibly arise if the whole property is sold. But that's not the facts that we're dealing with. It's only a portion of the whole that we're talking about.
But these clients can be held in contempt of court if they breach this, now that an injunction's been entered. And they can't sell the property without the buyers being scared off because this document now has been recorded in the deed books. None of that's applicable for a breach of contract. We would say, Hornbook law, that none of those remedies are applicable, but yet your client got those remedies in this case. So why isn't the first and dispositive fork in the road, is this a property interest or is this a mere contractual interest?
Well, we think it's a property interest, because if you look at the terms of the contract, everything under the terms of the contract was completed. The house was built, the Beamans paid for the construction, the Beamans moved in. There's nothing left on the contract that remains to be done.
Well, this is a very elementary question, but if it's a real property interest, we have to have a description of the real property. What is the description of the real property?
I think the description in the contract lists the property by address, and I think that's
so
why.
So that's the description is 2169 Clark's Road, Rustburg, Virginia.
Well, that's the description, but.
And is that adequate? Would you say that's adequate for a deed, or just adequate for?
Well, I think it's adequate for purposes of allowing the parties to move forward on a declaratory judgment action to have the court really define the rights of the parties, and even, and this court has repeatedly said, when a deed or a writing has not met all the technical requirements, that the courts can really fill in the gaps based on the written instrument of the parties. And I think that's what we've asked the court to do here, because, I mean, there's no doubt about it. This was a mess. And unfortunately, counsel and I were not involved in drawing up this contract, but here we are trying to ask the court for some sort of interpretation of this contract, because I think the parties' intent was that the Vances wanted his mother and his father-in-law to be on the property for the remainder of their lives.
Unless the Beamans sold it, which they could have done, in theory, the day after the building was completed.
That is true.
Well, you can't do that to a property interest. As a matter of law, that is not a possible response.
Which is why we move forward with the declaratory judgment action, having the court define the rights.
Well, it seems to me you never asked for such a property interest. And I guess that's what we're talking about. Is this a life estate? Is it not a life estate? The parties never used those terms, ever. They wrote it without the benefit of lawyers. And when you look at the complaint for a declaratory judgment, there's nothing in there that says declare that they have a life estate. All it says is here's a written agreement attached as Exhibit 1. Declare that it's a valid enforceable contract giving these rights.
That's correct. The
discussion about this being a life estate actually is a little off the mark unless declaratory judgment and the enforcement of this cannot apply to anything that's not a life estate.
That's not That's not correct. I mean, the reason that we brought the declaratory judgment action is because we had a written contract. It wasn't clear what those rights were, and we have used the terms life estate trying to interpret the contract, but the Beamans don't care what kind of estate and land it is. All they
wait a minute, wait. What kind of estate and land? Once again, the difference is an estate and land versus a contractual license. Not what kind of estate. You're right. If it were an estate and land, it would probably call it the life estate, but that's not the issue.
And what we're trying to do is...
But if you really want to interpret this contract that never used the word life estate, why are you trying to tell us it is?
Well,
it doesn't matter, does it, to you?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. All the Beamans care is to live there for the remainder of the life. The problem with a license, I mean, there's a problem with the life estate, there's a problem with the license. The problem with the license is that it could be freely revocable, and the advances could come in one day after moving into the property and said, you're out.
That's right. And for that reason, Justice Kelsey's completely right. It can't be a life estate if you can eject them from it.
Yes.
So he's got to be right, and you have to accept that because you know it's true, too. So why are we talking about it being a life estate?
Well, Your Honor, I concede it's not necessary. We want, the Beamans just want to live in the property for the remainder of their life. Whatever you call it, they just want to have the right to live there.
Well, you don't get an injunction for a license to use, even a lifetime license to use. But you got an injunction, which means that these clients are subject to the contempt power of the court for breaching of contract, which would be quite anomalous for a court to do. You also ask in your complaint that a copy of the court's ruling be recorded in the land records to give the public notice of the Beamans' interest in the property. Well, I would expect that the real estate attorneys would interpret what the trial judge did in this case as actually creating a life estate, a land kenyan. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yes,
you lose your injunction, and you lose your land record recordation if this is not a interest in property. You're stuck with contract remedies, and that which was not litigated here and may be litigated in the other case or some future case. Of course, if that's true, you also lose on res judicata principles all the damages accrued to date. So it's a huge distinction. The bus goes off the cliff in terms of remedies when it goes from a property interest to a mere contractual interest.
I would agree with that, and one of the problems that is not necessarily before this court is that a judgment is probably meaningless in this case. In the underlying action, there was two cases, that there was a breach of contract case for purchasing a piece of equipment that was not paid back, $40,000 uncollectible. Breach of contract is pretty much meaningless in this particular case. They could kick them out.
So that's why we're stressing out all these other doctrines.
Possibly, yes. But we believe that declaratory judgment action would be proper to construe the terms of the contract, because a breach of contract action wouldn't remedy the wrongs that were created here. Specific performance will not cure or resolve the problems. What the Vances have done is the house was already built, the Beamans moved in, the house was paid for. I mean, there's nothing left to be done under the contract, so I don't think a breach of contract action would be appropriate, nor would monetary damages provide adequate relief. Because what the Vances are doing is obstructing use of the property, denying that the Beamans have the right to live in the property, and they're threatening eviction. And the breach of contract action is not going to cure those problems. And that's why we move forward with the declaratory judgment action, because that's the only way that we can get some interpretation of the contract. The purpose of the declaratory judgment action is to guide the parties with respect to their future conduct towards one another. We want to know whether the Beamans have a right to remain on this property. And that's why we move forward with a declaratory judgment action. I think the case that's most appropriate is the Hoffman case, where you have an owner that had leased out the premises to another tenant. The tenant was operating a gasoline station. The owner then sells the property to a third party who then leases out that property to another tenant. So what you have is two tenants arguing over who has the right to be on the property. The owner, or the new tenant, is disputing that they have the right to be on that property. Their attorney sends a letter to the original tenant and says, if you continue to come on this property, we're going to prosecute you for trespass, we're going to seek damages, and the original owner finds himself in a predicament and files a declaratory judgment action asking the court to construe the lease, tell the parties who has the right to be on the property, and whether the new tenant and its customers' employees will be subjected to criminal prosecution. And this court, ruled that it was appropriate for a declaratory judgment action because they were guiding the parties with respect
to... Okay, so you get a deck action. That doesn't mean you get an injunction. That doesn't mean you get a lifetime a property interest in the estate that's recorded in the deed books. So you get a deck action. That just means you get into court. That doesn't tell you anything about the substantive rights and liabilities underlying it.
Well, it allows the court to construe the writing. And
it doesn't allow the court to issue an injunction when you're construing a contract and specific performance is otherwise unavailable. Because injunctions are not proper remedies for breach of contract.
I agree with that statement, Your Honor. In conclusion, I would ask this court to... there's one more point that I would like to add, and I would be remiss if I did not bring it up, is that we believe that assignment of error number two is now moot because the Vances failed to assign error to the ruling and holding by the trial court that equitable estoppel denied the Vances the right to deny that the validity and enforceability of the contract applied. And for that reason, we believe that the contract should be enforced. And in conclusion, I ask that this court affirm the trial court's decision.
Before you sit down, the actual pleading that you have requests that the court enter a judgment declaring that the written agreement is valid and enforceable, number one. Number two, that it's binding on the plaintiffs and the defendants and is enforceable by its terms. I guess that's really a repeat of number one. That the defendants do not have the right to restrict the plaintiff's use and enjoyment of the house or evict them from the house. That a copy of the ruling be recorded in the land records. That's sort of an unusual outlier there. That the plaintiffs recover their costs and fees, etc. I guess the question is, can you have, if your deck action was proper and the injunction was not, where do you stand?
Well, if the deck action is proper...
The trial court declares all those things, you just don't get an injunction.
What does
that do to you?
Well, we still think that the trial court can define the rights of the parties with respect to occupying the premises. And further, recording the order in the land records of the property to put the world on notice that the Beamans have the right to reside on the property.
Well, why is that important to you? It seems to me it's only important to you so nobody will want to buy the house.
Well, yeah.
If that's what the purpose of it is.
Or to put, it might not be apparent that someone is going to come onto the property and make a visual inspection. So we do want it. We want it recorded on the land record so that the world is on notice.
Why? I keep asking why. What? Why?
Well, I mean, they like the property. They want to live there, but they also want to be notified that if the property were sold, someone comes. They don't want to be someone to come in at the 11th hour and say, "You guys are out," and here we are, not knowing what to do, and then they have to turn around.
There's no right in the contract to that, right? Nothing in the contract says that can't happen.
That's right, but then we have to resort to a breach of contract against the Vances because under the terms of the contract, it specifies that if the house was sold, then the Vances are to provide a similar house of the same size and privileges. So then we have to revert back to...
But that doesn't affect subsequent purchase or title.
Excuse me, Your Honor, I didn't hear you.
That would not affect, even if you put it in the land records, it wouldn't affect the subsequent purchaser's title. This is not an interest that's recognizable in land. Yeah, you'd have a contract action, but it would be against the Vances.
Correct.
Well, I guess the final question is that if this is right on the declaratory judgment and wrong on the injunction, what does that do to you?
Well, we're just left with the trial court's ruling that the Beamans have the right to live on the property. It doesn't talk about obstructing use, and it doesn't talk about the right to have access and ingress and egress from the property.
Well, why couldn't it talk about those things without issuing an injunction, just saying those are rights that you have pursuant to the contract? What's wrong with that?
I guess it could.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Sanzone, you have 6 minutes and 42 seconds left.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, I'll say, again, they were talking about, in their argument, threatening eviction. That's not part of the evidence in this case. And I think the court is right to focus on what they requested in their declaratory judgment action and then what relief was granted in this case. And the court, by simply restating the writing in this case, and attempting by adding some language to convert it over into a life estate has created something that's not permitted. The law of property is the oldest law problem that we have. And it's so well established over the law review article that said you can't create new estates and land. And this is going to create one if it's a land, because you have a non-possessory life estate. Essential. I mean, it has all the requisites of a life estate. And you have the person who is the original owner of the property who granted this life estate having the right to sell it at any time for any purpose. I think that the real purpose of all of this is that the Beamans have the Vances in a position that the Vances have to buy them out. And our whole presentation in this brief is essentially Plan B. Because Plan A in this case involved the fact that the Beamans had been in bankruptcy and had had a house and stopped paying on it. They had two houses, in fact, and then they built this addition. And we were saying essentially that they were attempting to defraud probably their creditors by putting some money over here, and that at a later time would come back and be able to have this property sold and get their money back. And we had alleged the equitable estoppel, but as Justice King said in our writ hearing, he said that these first two issues really subsumed the last, so that's not important now. What is important is that they still have other ways to proceed, I think is actually the way that it's stated in the statute of the old law. They had an adequate contract remedy.
Suppose the court were to decide that declaratory judgment was actually appropriate to determine the rights of these parties to this contract, but the remedy of injunction was wrong. Where does that put you?
Well, I think it puts us in a position that they cannot issue an advisory opinion, so that the opinion that the court issues can't be purely...
By the way, we have to start. Declaratory judgment is about as close to an advisory opinion as you get. That's
yes.
Permissible in the law. Parties disagree... Advise us, court. What are our rights, all right? And that's permissible under the Declaratory Judgment Act. So let's say that they're right. You can get a declaratory judgment on this contract, but you can't have the remedy of injunction. Where does that put you?
Well, Mr. Chief Justice, I think you have to start from the point of view that they have to have a demonstration that there's some prospect of harm, some prospect of a right that needs to be resolved.
Assume that we're beyond that, okay? We're beyond that. The court has just issued an opinion, and it says a declaratory judgment is proper, but the injunction is wrong. Where does that put you?
That both parties can enforce the rights that they have granted under the writing. I guess it is very basic form. But I think we need to stick to the writing, and I don't think we need to add so many things as have been added here. Because if you look at this order, it's the writing plus, 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 but it's not really related to the pleadings. And there's just a lot that's been added here that's absolutely not necessary.
What are you talking about? What is unnecessary? What are you talking about was added that was unnecessary?
Rights to ingress, egress. You know, the problems that we're talking about here, they've never been prevented from going onto the property.
Right, but what's wrong with the court saying that they have a right to all those things as long as it doesn't issue an injunction to enforce that right?
It certainly can state what the right is.
Well, it can state what the right is within the meaning of the right.
Correct.
And I think that's what you're limited to. And I think that's what we're going to have some evidence about the writing itself. And I don't think that the findings that they made in this case relate to that. I think they relate to essentially a life estate, if you will. And I think that it's clearer, perhaps, even in the second suit that's down here before the court, which we've only appealed on the issue of attorney's fees, because attorney's fees are granted. But I think that's where you're going to be, Mr. Chief Justice and the Honorable Justice. I think that's where we'll be later if the court rules the way that you've suggested. But I do think that this case has a dangerous possibility. And in the Hopin case that they talked about, the reason declaratory relief was appropriate in that case is that there had been an owner who sold it to someone, and then there was a tenant in between. And the tenant had the right to dispense gasoline, and the owner, the original owner, tore the gasoline pumps out, and they weren't there any longer. So the people, I guess...
Mr. Sanzone, may I interrupt? Yes. I'm having trouble understanding why you place so much emphasis on the availability or non-availability of a deck action. That's just a procedural device. It doesn't change any substantive legal principle at all. Whether there's whatever the scope of this contractual right is or isn't is not governed by the deck action statute. It's governed by contract law. So yes, as you've been asked, a deck action, a breach of contract action, it's just a vehicle to get the case in the court.
Yes, and to the extent that we do that, I don't object to that. I think that's rather appropriate. But in this case, that's not what happened. In this case, it was used as a vehicle to create a new estate and land. It was used for an injunction to be granted. And now we're proceeding for violations of the court order, not back to the original writing. So we're not trying to decide did they do something wrong under the original writing. Now we're trying to decide if this is left in place. Did we do something wrong under the court order, which brings a whole new realm of remedies in play that should not be. So, and the last thing I'll say about Hopkins, both had the possessory right in that case, but the tenant had left the property, and they were asking, could the tenant come back in and disrupt the possessory interest? That's different than here because both had a possessory interest.
So, all right. Well, your time has expired. Next time you come back, let your son argue, too.
Right? Yes, I may just let him argue. Thank you so much.
Call the next case.